Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says we'll go it alone.
We face a genocidal enemy that we have to defeat in order to assure our future.
Using frozen Russian assets to supply Ukraine with weapons.
Using the interest, which might amount to, I don't know, $7 or $8 billion a year.
And born completely deaf, a young girl can hear now after getting groundbreaking gene therapy.
She heard the phrase near normal hearing. She was turning to really soft sounds.
Today is Friday, May 10th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Scott Walterman. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said Thursday that a U.S. threat to withhold some arms would not prevent Israel from continuing its offensive in Gaza, indicating it might proceed with an invasion of the packed city of Rafah against the wishes of its closest ally. Netanyahu made his case in an interview with Dr. Phil, airing on Thursday at 0000 GMT on Merit and streaming on Merit Plus.
Are Palestinians complicit in this, or are they just hiding among them? I know they're doing that, but are Palestinians, some, complicit in this?
You have actually both conditions, because we went into buildings, residential buildings, where these terrorists hide, and where they shoot from. They go to hospitals, schools, residential areas. But when we went into these residential areas, we found tablets. And in the tablet, you have, you open the tablet and you see a picture of Adolf Hitler. And then in another building, you see a picture, in another apartment, you see texts of Hitler's Mein Kampf, which is work that itemized and planned, laid the plan for the destruction of the 6 million Jews in the Holocaust. So they're immersed in this. They educate their children to this unfathomable hatred of Jews, to this murderous mentality, and many comply with it. And those who don't, they're used as human shields anyway. They use them as human shields, and they target civilians, and they hide behind their civilians, their own civilians. They target ours, hide behind theirs. That is a double war crime. And, of course, this makes Israel's task so much more difficult.
The United States believes a major military operation in Rafah would weaken Israel's position in hostage talks with Hamas. Here's State Department spokesman Matthew Miller.
A major military operation in Rafah would further weaken Israel's standing in the world, would further create distance from its partners in the region, who actually share Israel's goal of seeing Hamas defeated and want to see Hamas replaced with a different governance structure in Gaza.
So let's dig down on this. Joining us now to talk about it is Michael Provenz, a professor at the University of California, San Diego, where he teaches modern Middle East history, focusing on the 20th century Arab East. He joins us from Lebanon. So we're in whole new territory for this conflict, with President Biden threatening not to send certain kinds of weapons if they go into Rafah, Israel saying we'll go it alone. Is this just show?
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, Biden has to, he's got real problems domestically with upset young people on university campuses, with a lot of people in the Democratic Party who are critical, of Israel, and also of the especially of the Gaza campaign. And Biden came out full-throated endorsement of everything, and then it started to really cost him. And so, he's trying, I think, probably trying to have it both ways. We'll see if it works. Netanyahu is an old hand at manipulating and taking advantage of and flouting the guardrails that American presidents try to put up for him. So he's not an easy person to manage.
I mean, it's obviously, you know, I think I say it's obvious. I don't know, maybe that Biden is doing this as a reaction to the campus and pushback on the Palestinian campaign.
Yeah.
And Netanyahu's in a place where, so somebody said to us earlier this week, they have to put themselves, both Hamas and Israel, in a place where at the end of all of this, they can claim victory. And, you know, the objectives are murky as long as they can claim, it doesn't really matter as long as they can claim victory.
Well, I mean, for Netanyahu, that's almost impossible. And I mean, you would have thought that he'd learned the lessons of recent Israeli military, especially serious military campaigns. I mean, it happens that I'm in Lebanon right now. And in 2006, I witnessed the war here in Lebanon between Israel and Hezbollah, but really the entire Lebanese state. And that led to the defeat of, you know, arguably the Israeli forces. They fought for 34 days and they ended up basically retreating and having achieved none of their goals. These kind of overarching goals, like Netanyahu has articulated, about completely defeating an Arab political party or force, this is not really something that he can control. So, you know, by setting those kinds of goals, there's no victory possible, actually. Unless he annihilates, I mean, they've already destroyed practically everything that life depends upon in Gaza for the people who live there. And they've also killed 35,000 people. So this is not inconsequential at all. But it's, you know, if total victory over Hamas is the way he defined the end game, he's not there and he'll never get there. And people realize, and he realizes, that anything less than that means that he's going to be thrown out of office pretty quickly and maybe go to jail. So, you know, he's really, and I think the Israeli public realizes that now too.
I mean, it sort of reminds me, in a way, it's not the first time an Israeli prime minister has threatened the U.S. administration will go it alone. I mean, Golda Meir said that to the Nixon administration when they were wavering on support for that war because, you know, of gas prices and Nixon having his own problems with Watergate.
Almost exactly 50 years ago. That's right. No, it's not a new thing. The domestic pressure on Biden might be new. And, you know, we're going to see in the next few months whether things have really changed and whether a mobilized, passionate, youthful opposition to association with what a lot of people think are, you know, Israeli war crimes, is going to be a real problem for the Democratic Party. And if it is, in the long term, you know, look for things to change, I imagine, because if the young folks stay at home and don't vote, you know, I suppose Donald Trump will become president, which will be worse from a perspective of this part of the world. But it will be a lesson that the Democratic Party can't possibly ignore. Hmm. So those things are, you know, there's a lot of things up in the air right now, for sure.
How do you see this really playing out over the next month?
Well, I mean, it looked like Hamas had issued or had agreed and put Netanyahu in a kind of a rough spot. He said they'll never agree, and then they agreed, and they accepted the ceasefire that was talked about a few days ago. I've been in an airplane, so I'm not as close to the ground on some of these recent developments as I might have been, but you know, that put him in a difficult space too. And he said, Biden said, don't go to Rafah, that Hamas said, we have a deal. And he said, we don't have a deal. We'll never have a deal. And we're going to Rafah. So this is the, this, these are the gyrations of a desperate man, I would say. A desperate man with a tremendous, unbelievable capacity for destruction. you know, how long can it continue? Who knows? Hopefully not much longer.
Thank you so very much for the time.
Anytime, Scott.
Professor Michael Provins from the University of California, San Diego, joining us from Lebanon. Displaced Palestinians are fleeing Rafah, fearing an Israeli ground offensive is imminent, and Deir al-Balah in the central Gaza Strip is now crammed with people. Reuters correspondent Lucy Fielders says people are struggling to find a place to set up camp.
Amani El-Fayoumi is among those who can't find anywhere to set up camp.
We have been sleeping in the cold for 4 days, and there is no place to set up our tent. Where will all the displaced people go?
Sumaya Shaaban and her children have been sat by the road for 3 days. What little aid there is doesn't reach them.
We are without life's necessities. We take water from the sea for our children. There are no bathrooms. There is no food. There is no site supporting us.
Israeli tanks seized the Gaza side of the Rafah border crossing with Egypt on Tuesday, cutting off a vital aid route and forcing at least 80,000 people to flee the southern city this week, according to the United Nations. That could be just the beginning. Residents fear Israeli strikes on Rafah. The biggest urban area in Gaza, not yet overrun by Israeli ground forces, are a sign an invasion is imminent. Like many Gazans, the Al-Kafana family have been displaced several times during the conflict and are now on the move again, this time from Rafah to the Al-Mawasi area of Khan Yunis, where they've been told, once again, they'll be safe. Leila Al-Kafana.
We keep moving from one place to another. This child was born during the war. What did he do wrong? He was born in Rafah. There are no clothes.
Israel says it must hit Rafah to defeat thousands of Hamas fighters it says are holed up there.
Reuters correspondent Lucy Fielder. We're following these other stories from around the world. 6 months into an offensive against Myanmar's military government, opposition forces have made massive gains. But civilian casualties are rising sharply as regime troops increasingly turn toward scorched earth tactics. Russia wrapped itself in patriotic pageantry for Victory Day. President Vladimir Putin celebrated the defeat of Nazi Germany in World War II by hailing his forces in Ukraine and blasting the West for fueling conflicts around the world. Switzerland and the Netherlands, two of the favorites to win Eurovision 2024, secured spots in Saturday's grand finale, along Israel, despite large protests against the country's participation and booing during its performance. 100,000 visitors have gathered in the southern Swedish city of Malmö for the annual event, under heavy police presence as authorities brace for possible unrest. In our continuing coverage of the 2024 presidential election, while both the Biden and Trump campaigns share their messaging on abortion, VOA's Veronica Balderas-Iglesias reports on how the issue of reproductive rights is faring in the mind of citizens and lawmakers ahead of the election.
While campaigning for reproductive rights in Pennsylvania on Wednesday, Vice President Kamala Harris, President Joe Biden's running mate, condemned abortion restrictions being enforced in several states, including Florida's ban on abortions more than 6 weeks after inception.
We have to just call it for what it is. Do you not trust women? To know what is in their own best interest? You, some legislator in some state capital, the majority of whom are not women, are in a better position to tell her what she should do? We're going to vote.
Biden says if re-elected, he will restore Roe v. Wade, a landmark Supreme Court decision that for 5 decades ensured a woman's right to an abortion. The presumptive Republican presidential nominee, Donald Trump, took to his Truth social media platform on May 5th to underscore his position on the topic. He wrote that the abortion matter is up to the states, that it will never go back to the federal government, and that the country will soon start uniting on this long contentious issue. Three of the five Supreme Court justices who voted to overturn Roe v. Wade in 2022 were appointed by Trump. Currently, 41 states ban abortions after some period, ranging from 6 to 24 weeks after gestation, with certain exceptions, according to the Guttmacher Institute. The restrictions have motivated many voters, says Jo Becker with Human Rights Watch. She was interviewed via Skype.
We've seen state ballot measures that have really turned out women voters in particular to try and enshrine abortion rights in their state.
Both the Trump and the Biden campaigns are counting on a state-by-state strategy to see whether abortion is a winning issue in the 2024 general election, says George Mason University law professor Helen Alvarez, who identifies herself as a pro-life Democrat. She was interviewed via Skype.
The degree to which the Biden campaign has made it, I think, you know, the New York Times and others are calling it their number one issue. That's a strategy decision they've made, and it could give them a couple percentage points advantage. That said, it's in deep competition with questions about the economy, inflation, and immigration.
Interviewed in North Carolina, Duke University student Amaya Clayton told VOA's Spanish service that she and her peers see reproductive rights as a big issue.
That's been a constant conversation in the U.S. since the overturning of Roe with Dobbs v. Jackson. And so I think that's something that a lot of students are very passionate about and caring about a lot.
In New Hampshire, Republican State Representative Jim Kofold says he's heard a range of concerns among voters.
There's a lot of concern that at the state level, we're going to apply widespread restrictions on abortion. But that has not been the case at all this legislative cycle. I think there is a much longer conversation that we need to have as a society about, you know, how we feel about that and where we think it's appropriate to draw the line.
The debate, however, is turning into legislative battles, mostly along party lines in states like Arizona, where a near total abortion ban was recently repealed. Analysts expect the legal battles will continue at the state level, but caution it's still early to predict whether abortion will be the issue that voters will prioritize when heading to the polls in November. Veronica Valderas Iglesias, VOA News, Washington.
The European Union has agreed in principle to a deal that would use the proceeds from frozen Russian assets to supply weapons for Ukraine. As Henry Ridgewell reports, allies in Washington want the EU to go much further.
Russia's central bank held billions of dollars of cash and assets in Western financial institutions and companies. Those assets were frozen by the West in the wake of Moscow's February 2022 invasion of Ukraine. The United States, along with Britain and Canada, have been pushing for those assets to be fully seized and used to help Kyiv fight Russia's invasion. But Europe is being more cautious. European Union ambassadors meeting in Brussels Wednesday agreed in principle to use only the interest earned on the Russian assets. Ian Bond is an analyst at the Centre for European Reform.
Which might amount to, I don't know, 7 or 8 billion a year.
The deal should be fully signed off at an EU finance ministers' meeting next week. Henry Ridgewell, VOA News.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Scott Walterman. With deaths nearing 240 and about 235,000 people displaced, Kenyans are mourning their lost loved ones and trying to rebuild after weeks of heavy rains that resulted in deadly floods and landslides. And it's not over yet, as more rains are expected throughout June. Here's VOA Nairobi Bureau Chief Mariama Diallo.
At Mathare North Primary School, Beatrice Achieng has been preparing food the past 2 weeks for the hundreds of flood victims who are being sheltered in this internally displaced people campsite. She's with Tushinde Children's Trust.
They are living here almost 300 people, and I'm only able to feed 200.
Monica Musioka came here after losing her home in the recent floods. Her four children are not able to go to classes.
We hope government will help us with the books to build classes.
Rain is still expected in many parts of the country, but the storms won't be as intense as they've recently been. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Nairobi.
And finally, Opal Sandy was born completely deaf. Now she can hear. Opal has become the first British patient and youngest person ever to receive a groundbreaking treatment using gene therapy. Jo Sandy is her mother. She said it was really miraculous.
24 weeks post-surgery, and we heard the phrase near normal hearing. She was turning to really soft sounds.
Her dad, James Sandy.
They played us the sounds that she was turning to, and we were quite mind-blown by how soft it was, how quiet it was. Like they're sounds that I think in day-to-day life you might not even notice yourself, sort of thing.
The ear surgeon, Professor Manohar Banse, says it's a game changer.
We can start to use gene therapy in young children, restore hearing for a variety of different kinds of genetic hearing loss, and then have a more one-and-done type approach where we actually restore the hearing. They don't have to have cochlear implants and other technologies that have to be replaced.
Pretty remarkable. This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of everyone at VOA, thank you so much for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, you can follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. In Washington, I'm Scott Walterman.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The 15 members of the United Nations Security Council voted in late April on a resolution to ban nuclear weapons in space. 13 representatives voted for the resolution. China abstained, and just one, Russia, voted against it. On April 24th, Russia vetoed a resolution that would have reaffirmed the shared goal of all states on preventing an arms race in outer space and urged exploration and use of outer space for peaceful purposes, said Robert Wood, United States Alternative Representative for Special Political Affairs.
It would have affirmed the obligations of all states parties to the Outer Space Treaty not to place any objects carrying nuclear weapons or any other kinds of weapons of mass destruction in orbit around Earth, a treaty that 115 countries have joined, including Russia and China. It would have also called on member states not to even develop nuclear weapons specifically designed for placement in orbit. And it would have reduced the risk of a nuclear detonation in space.
Russia's defense of the veto before the UN General Assembly consisted of a list of accusations against the United States and Western nations, including supposed plans to deploy weapons. Russia then presented its own resolution calling for a ban on the deployment of any weapons in outer space. Russia's resolution is designed to divide rather than unite member states, said Ambassador Wood.
Make no mistake, this is a diplomatic facade that hides Russia's true intentions. The truth is that Russia currently has several conventional anti-satellite weapons already in orbit, one of which it tested in 2019. Moreover, Russia has repeatedly threatened satellites for targeting with weapons to include commercial satellites.
Indeed, there is credible information that Russia is developing a new satellite carrying a nuclear device, said Ambassador Wood. Russia's actions cast significant doubt as to whether it will uphold its existing legal obligations under the Outer Space Treaty and raise concerns about what this could mean for international peace and security, said Ambassador Wood. This is why it is so critical for all of us to raise our voices today in support of the Outer Space Treaty and its clear prohibition on placing nuclear weapons in orbit.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.